May it please the court, my name is Anne Gill, registration number 14610, appearing on behalf of the husband, Sean Rossi. The issues in this case primarily involve the property division. In the property division, the first task of the trial court is to determine whether property is separate or marital. And our first issue is whether the trial court in this case incorrectly decided that certain properties were marital rather than separate. Husband brought several things to the marriage, which the court disagreed with his position that they were separate property. We're challenging the characterization of an IRA account, a rollover IRA account, and a brokerage account, which he brought to the marriage. The trial court decided that those were not adequately established as separate properties because of the evidence the husband presented as to them. I think that there are certain factors that we need to look at to determine whether property is separate on these accounts. We need to determine the value at the time of marriage or close proximity to the marriage. Here, the marriage was in 2001. At the time of the permanent orders hearing, husband was handicapped and finding documentation deriving from 2001 close at the date of the marriage. He provided the best documentation he could find, and then he testified as to how he characterized those documents as determining the value of the account.
Ms. Gill, isn't that within the province of the trial court to determine whether or not the information that Mr. Rossi presented was sufficient to show that this was separate property?
It is within the trial court's discretion under marriage of, and I'm going to butcher the name, Krejci, K-R-E-J-C-I, 2013 decision. This court determined that an abuse of discretion can weigh the evidence as a whole to determine whether the court abused its discretion. In light of the evidence husband presented here, I'm arguing that the court did abuse its discretion. As to the one IRA account, husband introduced the evidence of the value of the account at the beginning of the year. The marriage was in March. And I think that if, when we recognize that IRAs are creature of statute with a defined amount of contribution that can be made during 1 year, the fact that the husband was claiming that that account had a separate value of $25,000 and that was determined to be the value of the account later in the year with a cap of some $6,000 that could be contributed in a year, I think it was an abuse of discretion to say that all of that was marital. A similar argument applies, I believe, to the IRA rollover account in which husband asserted a separate component of some $32,000. And that he had a valuation in January of the following year, and he testified as to the monthly contributions he made throughout the years of that first year of the marriage and walked it back from the value in January of 2002 to what he thought the value would have been in March 2001, the date of the marriage. I think that in light of that testimony and documentary evidence, that it was an abuse of discretion to reject that as establishing the value of separate property. I would submit to you that particularly when you're looking at separate property dating back a significant period of time in which bank records may not be available, investment records may not be available, for that it would be appropriate to give weight to the combination of the available documentation that was less than a year from the date of the marriage, in some cases just a matter of weeks or a few months, and in fact the explanation for why precise documentation was not available. I do not think that this...
Pardon me. I'm a little confused, counsel, because basically what we're talking about is a finding of fact by the trial court. Is that not correct?
Yes.
All right.
I would actually back up, if I may, Your Honor, and say it's a mixed question of fact and law, because it leads to the conclusion, the legal conclusion, whether it was separate or marital.
Understood. But to the extent it dealt with findings of fact as to how much was contributed prior to the marriage and how much was contributed after the marriage. Was there not sufficient evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding piece of it? I understand you're saying the legal conclusion is wrong, and you're saying that the court abused its discretion. I'm just trying to figure out what the evidence was.
Well, I cited the evidence in my brief, but I think that the husband that presented what documentation he could find after the lapse of over 10 years. And
so it was somewhat in dispute then, I guess, as to what the facts actually were, and the trial court made a finding based on what the court thought was correct. Have I got that wrong?
I would not characterize it that way, Your Honor. I think that there was a combination of documentation and testimony, the court came to the legal conclusion that he had not established separate property.
Well, isn't that because he disbelieved some of the husband's testimony?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I do not think there was a credibility determination involved in that.
Or a sufficiency of the evidence, perhaps. I'm just trying to figure out how, what the trial court did, what your problem is with it in terms of the facts as opposed to the legal application.
Okay, I would argue that in light of the fact that this was a 2001 marriage, husband presented all the evidence that was available and that should be sufficient. I would actually think that when you have some documentation, there's testimony explaining what is there and the explanation why there was not complete documentation. I think that also rolls over into what your burden of proof is. The burden of proof is a preponderance of the evidence in this case, and I think that the trial court was looking at a much higher standard without articulating it. Because
how are we supposed to determine that if the trial court didn't articulate it?
I think that it's one of the bizarre aspects of property divisions and valuations in marriages that so often we end up with forensic accountants or experts who come down to the pennies, and if the pennies don't match up, it's not established.
Right, but that's not the case we had here.
No, it's not, but I think that
we had some imprecise evidence, and the trial court made a determination of what the facts were based on, in part on that imprecise evidence. Mm-hmm. Am I mischaracterizing?
I would call it imprecise. I think that there was...
You're saying it's the best evidence that was available.
Yes.
That's why I'm concluding it's probably slightly imprecise.
I would not choose that word to describe it.
So, Ms. Gill, you said this was the best evidence available. Was there any testimony from a financial advisor or anybody else that this was in fact the best evidence available?
No, the husband said that this was all he was able to find, that he had attempted to trace back, that bank records had not been available, other things dating back that far, simply he could not find, and he made his best effort to obtain information.
Wasn't there a second reason given for finding this to be marital property, namely that even if the amounts had been established as of the time of the marriage, there was commingling after the fact, and there was transfer of some of the property for other property, and it was just impossible to go back and determine the amount that the husband actually brought?
Your Honor, I would love to address that, and I think that those are significant things. First of all, I believe that the case law is pretty clear that IRAs and retirement accounts are traditionally valued as a single asset, and I've spent a lot of time going to the case law from Burford on trying to find a clear definition of a single asset, because the starting point for your question is if it's a single asset, you look at the value at the time of the marriage. If there's an increase in value, that's marital subject to division. And the IRAs are traditionally treated as a single asset, and you look at whether they've increased, and any increase is marital subject to division. And that's done in a number of cases, like a Powell, and I think Creechy, and
okay.
Other cases.
Well, let me rephrase my question. In her order, the trial judge found there had been that the marital property had been converted to marital property, quote, by commingling or failing to segregate and trace separate property through the marriage. She cites a case called In Re Marriage of Dale and also Stump. You're saying that those cases don't apply because these are IRA accounts?
I think that the trial court was wrong on that. I think that Dale, let's see.
She cites at the top of page six.
Yes, and please bear with me. My memory is not what it used to be. And I remember going through that, and the Dale case primarily involved purchase of a car and the tracing from a premarital car to a car purchased during the marriage. I think that's distinguishable. I think that the IRAs are unique assets and are treated as a single asset, so you look at date of marriage, date of permanent orders. And that brings me to the argument I would like to present to you as to the brokerage account, which I think is where the trial court was concerned with commingling and the other had a separate component. I urge you to find that a brokerage account is a single asset. First of all, everyone calls it a brokerage account. They don't look at what's held within the brokerage account to value any items within it. I think that's analogous to an IRA, which traditionally will have a mix of investment components with the IRA. And here, the trial court looked at the brokerage account. It always called it a brokerage account. It didn't say, well, there's this component and that component. And I would urge you to go from the Burford case, which talks about valuing a single asset, to the much more recent case, Kregci, K-R-E-G-C-I, in which Judge Webb appears to be treating an investment account as a single asset. In the Kregci case, the issue was wife's inheritance during the marriage, and she put it into the joint account. And at page 1039, Judge Webb explains how the computation should be handled as to whether wife kept her inheritance separate or how it was treated in that joint investment account. But he talks about valuing the investment account when the inheritance was put in and the value of the investment account at the date of permanent orders. There is not a separate issue of in and out except for wife's inheritance, which she was claiming as separate. In this case, husband had his separate investment account prior to marriage. This account remained in his sole name through the marriage, and yes, he acknowledges that the increase from the date of marriage to the date of permanent orders is marital and is subject to division in this case. I would like to reserve my remaining 2 1/2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well, Ms. Gill. You have 2 minutes and 24 seconds for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Josh Sauer, registration number 35163. I'm assisted by the other partner in my firm, Brandy Peterson, registration number 39262, and I represent the appellee, Shelley Rossi. I also represented Ms. Rossi in the underlying district court action. The reason of reference is to maintain consistency with the designation of parties in the underlying caption as well as in my briefs. I'll refer to parties as husband and wife, and no disrespect is intended. The two positions I'd like to address with this court is that, number one, the district court correctly concluded that there was no discernible separate property component in husband's retirement accounts, brokerage accounts, and cash, and correctly concluded that the entirety of these assets were marital property. And second, that the district court's nearly equal division of the marital estate was not an abuse of the court's discretion and is amply supported by the record on appeal. The district court's permanent orders should be affirmed. On the first issue, as is indicated in my brief, the standard of review is that the trial court's division of property has great latitude. The court has great latitude in the distribution of marital property. And the appellate court must not disturb that decision on appeal absent a clear abuse of discretion. In addition, the courts in the state have recognized the concept underlying the act that that a marriage is a partnership or shared enterprise. On the first issue, husband cites In Re the Marriage of Powell and In Re the Marriage of Kretschke, and I will also botch that name, for the proposition that the district court in this case erred by finding that the husband had not met his burden to establish his separate property claims. However, these cases do not, as husband apparently argues, eliminate husband's burden to trace the different stocks and cash components in his accounts back to the date of marriage in this case. Rather, the courts in these two cases merely indicated that the district court did not abuse its discretion in its categorization and treatment of the accounts in those cases.
Mr. Sauer, let me interrupt you to ask you whether there is any evidence of tracing for the IRA accounts and the brokerage account at the permanent orders hearing.
No, Your Honor, there was no tracing. The husband had provided bank accounts from 2010 as part of the discovery request, and then the statements that Ms. Gill had referenced from around 2001, 2002 time period. But there were no documents, and there was no testamentary evidence of what was done in the in between those 2 days.
And is it your understanding that that was Mr. Rossi's obligation to present evidence of tracing of the money in those accounts that he asserted was separate property?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Stedman is the case, and there's many other cases that indicate that that is the person who is the proponent of the separate property claim. It is their burden to show that it is their separate property. And to discuss the cases cited by husband, the district court in Powell, Powell cited as if it indicates that the IRAs are always to be treated as separate assets, and that you would not go in there and evaluate the different components of that. My reading of Powell doesn't go that far. In that case, my understanding is that the appellate court in that case looked at what the district court did and did not find that there was an abuse of discretion in the application of those particular facts to the division of the marital property, such that the court indicated that, you know, it was appropriate, the court was fine, it was within its discretion to not accept the wife's expert's evaluation and testimony. And then the court also went on to state the small difference in percentages between the two positions of the parties, and then concluded that based on all of that, that the court had not abused its discretion in not taking the evidence in that case. The court's holding, in my view from that case, does not go so far as to say that courts must always treat the IRA as a single asset. And in fact, the article cited by husband in his brief doesn't necessarily say that either, at least it's not to the brokerage account. In that article, the brokerage account, the author, David Melton, opines, and it says within his opinion, that the entity approach, which is when you look at the IRA as a single asset versus the aggregate approach, when you look at all the different components of an asset or of a account such as an IRA, would depend on the kind of the account. And he even goes on to say that the brokerage account, if it had, you know, mutual, if it has money market type assets in it, if it has stocks and then cash and all those different things, then it could be a mixed entity and aggregate analysis in making that conclusion. So I think that was quite possibly the case here. In husband's statements, he indicated, and I'll cite the transcript here in a minute, but he did indicate that there were different aspects and amounts in the brokerage account potentially throughout the time that he had them in 2001. And it is true that the district court didn't go into what different types of things could have been in this brokerage account, but that's because that evidence wasn't before the court. All we had was the most recent years of what was in that account. We didn't have all that information going back to 2001 in front of the trial court for the court to even make that determination.
Excuse me, counsel. I'm trying to figure out if we were to take your learned opponent's position and adopt the Crazy case approach, what difference would it make in this case?
None. My argument is none. And here's why. I think that if that were the only thing the court had done wrong was to say, okay, you know, the husband should have gone back and had an expert go through all of those accounts and value which ones went up, which ones went down, and then created an analysis, which is often done in these cases. And if the court had said done just that one part incorrectly and everything else was fine, I would say there would be a difference. In this case, there's not, for a lot of reasons. One is that the husband did not provide any solid documentation at the time of the marriage, or really in enough close proximity an argument to be able to give a decent value of that. I mean, the amounts we're talking about here, like $25,000 or $30,000, and the fluctuation that could have been, I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult to tell The documents are provided, I don't think there's one document provided for one of them, really. The other two, they're tax forms that indicate for income purposes what the amounts were. As you look at these documents in the record, it's very difficult to sit there and clearly indicate, hey, this is the amount that he had from that time. And quite honestly, a very cynical person could sit there and say, maybe he didn't have any of that. They were married, he got it right after. And that brings me along to the credibility component of this case, is that I think in the prudent orders, I don't think that the judge went so far as to really attack or describe the credibility of either of these parties. But as you review the record, especially the beginning of the transcript and throughout, there were disclosures that were not made. There were instances, and I know this in the brief, where the husband indicated in the beginning that he was not receiving unemployment benefits. And it was very obvious, not only by the fact that we're going into a bank account and making transfers, that he indeed was receiving those, and he backpedaled in that testimony. And I think throughout, it's very clear from the record that there are some credibility issues with husbands and things he's saying. So,
but the judge made no findings on that.
The judge, you know, Your Honor,
can't make findings on that, even though you argue that he was not credible.
No, Your Honor, I will say, though, that the underlying record does support such a conclusion, and in that case, the court here can look through that and find and see that the court did not abuse its discretion because it made the findings that it did, because there wasn't compelling evidence to the contrary of its findings, such as the court saying that this was not sufficient evidence, that the documents and then the husband's testimony alone were not sufficient to get him to the amount that was declared separate property.
Okay. Had she found a separate property, it would have made a difference. Wouldn't she have had to have set aside the $25,000 or $30,000, take that out of the marital estate, and only divide the difference?
Yes, and I'm sorry, that wasn't what I was arguing. If the court did find that to be separate property, the court would have to do that. Mm-hmm. I guess my answer to the question was, if Ms. Gill is correct about the Kretschke case, does that mean that it automatically is separate property? And I say no, also for the fact that the husband did not show up that it was. The other issue in the case with the separate property component is that husband testified that there was commingling of these funds in the record. And so,
Mr. Sauer, doesn't evidence of commingling without evidence of tracing support the trial court's conclusion?
I think so, Your Honor. Under Seawall and other cases, I would say that it certainly is, and that's what I'm trying to get at here, is that the husband, clearly in some of his testimony, was asked about, and there was, in fact, it's in my brief, I go through a specific set of transactions that were made more recent to the hearing, but husband during that testimony indicates that he had done that throughout the marriage, or he says, you know, I spoke to the wife about doing that at times, and that's what we did. And so I agree. I mean, that would be our position, is that there was commingling, and then possibly, based on even what husband said, throughout the marriage. And the only way we can confirm that is because husband never produced all of those documents and statements. So that would be our position as well, is that there was commingling. Under the case law, he didn't come back and show the tracing that was necessary to be able to support a separate property claim. And therefore, the court couldn't find that those components, even if he had them at the time of the marriage, remained separate property and did not become marital by virtue of the transmutation or the commingling with marital funds. He also did put income in one of those accounts from his job during the marriage and other things. And I suppose in the brief by esteemed counsel, but the argument is, well, it doesn't matter maybe because as long as it just increases, you know, the separate property component is somehow still there. I don't think the case law supports that. And I think you could even make an argument, it's not something that we had in the record, we don't have statements from that time, but the husband could have, a year after the marriage, taken out $15,000 to $30,000, done something with it that made it marital, and then put it back into that separate account at some point later on. Again, I'm not saying that was actually the record, we didn't have those documents, but that could have happened. And therefore, another reason to require the tracing in this case. Without requiring the tracing and accepting husband's argument in this case would necessarily transfer the burden on wife to be able to show that husband's property is truly his own separate property, if that were required. There were things, I'm not sure I mentioned, but part of the issue with the statements not going back to at least the marriage or very close to the date of marriage is that at the trial court, they dealt with that by saying, you know, we can back out some of his contributions, but there would also be the increase in the property during that time, which they did not take into account, or the decrease. And so that's another issue that makes it impossible for the trial court. I mean, I really think husband at the end of the day would have been asking the trial court judge to guess at what his separate property was and to make a guesstimate on that and find that in his favor. And I think that actually would be an abuse of the court's discretion to have done that in this case. And the court really didn't know anything it could do when it had the documents that it had in the testimony and what happened in the case, it concluded that the property was marital by virtue of not being able to show even when it started or what the exact amounts or even close to the amounts were at the beginning, as well as testimony that the husband provided during the case that there were transactions that occurred between these accounts in such a manner that would make it separate property become marital. And I think that in the transcript on pages 65 to 70, I think it gives a clear indication of the husband's mindset in regards to his several property claims. He states within that he viewed all the money as his within these accounts because they came from his income. He clearly states the transfers were from jointly held accounts or debt vehicles to solely held accounts. And by debt vehicles, I mean specifically the HELOC in this case. So that was a jointly titled or debt. And so he would transfer funds freely between these two accounts. And when asked whether he thought that was commingling, his response was, no, I earned that money. That was all of my money. And so I think that he also indicated this was routine throughout his marriage. It was the normal course of his business, and therefore he wasn't in violation of the temporary automatic injunction that went into effect in the case, and that it was a free flow of cash between these accounts. That's all within the record. That is husband's testimony between pages 65 and 70, like I said. So I would indicate that the court, or that the husband in this case, by nature of his actions afterward, also commingled, and therefore the court could only make the finding that all of the accounts were marital in nature. And the husband also didn't provide any, I think as the court indicated, did not provide any experts to indicate that there were no other ways to get these documents. There was no testimony that he attempted any efforts to subpoena these documents. You know, it was merely husband saying that, you know, this is all I could get. And that I think then again the court properly found, based on the evidence and the facts before it, that it was appropriate to find that these that the property was marital in nature, and that the husband had not proven the separate property components, because to do otherwise would have been to, you know, leap beyond the evidence that the court had before. But Your Honor, that I'll spend the last of my time on the second issue. In this case, the trial court found that there would be no maintenance award to the wife, even though there was a good claim for that. I think that it was well within the court's, the division was well within the court's discretion. And certainly if this court ruled otherwise, we'd ask that maintenance and all that be revisited at the lower levels. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Sauer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think the attack on the husband's credibility is not well-founded. He was asked at different times as to whether he was receiving unemployment benefits during the months leading up to the permanent orders. He did receive unemployment benefits at certain times. They were canceled at certain times, then they were reinstated. So at the time that he said he was not receiving unemployment benefits, he wasn't. Subsequently at the permanent orders hearing, he was. So I think that if you look at his answers, they were truthful as to what was happening at exactly that time. I think the whole discussion about commingling funds is ignoring the fact that from the date of the marriage forward, husband was a very active investor. He considered all the increase in the value in the brokerage account to be marital subject to division. So the fact that he was moving money back and forth into the brokerage account, and one was down to zero and one was had a substantial value at the time of permanent orders, he said all that increase was subject to division. So the fact that the money's moved to different places, I think, is not commingling in the sense of separate to marital and pulling things out. And I think that's a misleading position in this particular situation, where he has agreed that all the increase in value is marital subject to division. As to the issue on maintenance, wife did not cross-appeal the denial of maintenance. She could have filed a protective notice of appeal if she wanted to preserve a claim for maintenance in this case. I do think that if you are accept my arguments and send this back for reconsideration of the property division here, that it is still possible that wife could receive adequate property to meet her reasonable needs. The court found that she had a shortfall of some $600 or $700 a month from her earned income as to her reasonable expenses. And I think that the property division of a couple hundred thousand dollars or more is more than enough to make up for her not having maintenance. I would ask that you reverse the trial court in this situation as I requested in my brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Gill. We appreciate your argument this afternoon. Mr. Sauer, we appreciate your argument as well. Ms. Patterson, thank you for your presence this afternoon. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.